This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. on www.prn.fm. This radio presentation replays my weekly TV show, Refounding America with Peter R. Breggin, MD, which can be watched on Brighteon.tv, and it's available on Roku. I interview guests who are heroes and pioneers in confronting the global predators who are behind COVID-19 lockdowns and vaccines, corrupt public health and medicine, global warming, the Great Reset, and other justifications for destroying the Western democracies. They are stealing our countries, our freedoms, our dignity and hope, and our jobs and our savings. For documentation of this worldwide tragedy, read our new book, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, by Peter and Ginger Breggin. Together, my guests and I explore what is happening and what we each can do to refound America and inspire the world. Thank you for your courage in facing these challenges and standing up for liberty. Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I have today for you a doc star. It's really a rock star, and he knows rock stars. So he's my first friend who's a rock star, doc star. It's going to be a very important interview. Things are going very, very well with us. The book is just selling around the world. We're getting the most amazing feedback on it. We have heard from a number of the doctors in COVID-19 who are working hard that it's the one book they're not finding any difficulties with. Nobody comes back and says, hey, there's a mistake here, there's a mistake there. There's no depth of this. The part that really surprises me, though, is that even in the field of politics, no one has gone as deep as COVID-19 and the global predators into this developing coalition that's been going on for decades and really started to coalesce around the vaccine campaign 10 years ago. Folks, it's Peter Breggin with an amazing guest that you'll meet in a minute or two. And you're watching Refounding America with a little bit of a subtitle that also says, Reclaiming Ourselves. My guest today is Peter A. McCullough, MD. Peter and I met very early at the start of COVID-19. I'm not sure how. And I was just enormously impressed. This man with 600 more publications, a professor here and a professor there, and the editor-in-chief of a cardiac journal and specializing in renal cardiac relationships. Now, when I was in med school, that would make me gloss over. I mean, it takes a level of mathematical, chemical, imaginative work to be able to think about all these things that are going on in the blood and the kidneys and the and then the heart and the lungs and the, oh my God. I mean, it's this is high tech science. And I saw that he was kind of shy about it, but he was going to risk all that and take on the truth of COVID-19. And he has done that. And he has become the world's leading scientist in spreading the hard factual truth about COVID-19, what's going on, what isn't going on. He's published 20 more papers or so. I don't know how he does that. So let's welcome my friend. It's such a blessing for him to be my friend and Ginger's friend, Peter A. McCullough, MD, MPH.
Well, thanks for having me to the show.
There you are. I just got to see you.
Good
so, Peter, what are you doing right now? Catch us up on your glorious work.
You know, I'm just off the incredible tidal wave of enthusiasm and interest after Joe Rogan, the Joe Rogan Experience. I went down there in the first week of December, went down to Austin into the studio, into the man cave with Joe Rogan, the most legendary podcaster. And I went 3 hours. I went 15 rounds with Joe Rogan, and it was about the data. And I brought my laptop computer, and he saw the slides. He saw that I was basically quoting the studies on COVID-19. His eyes were big as saucers. People tell me for the first time he was as quiet as a mouse as I was basically showing him the data about the effectiveness of early treatment, the efforts to suppress early treatment, and now what we have with vaccine safety and efficacy.
Well, that's just amazing, Peter. What kind of feedback do you get from something like that? Big as that.
We found out that that episode had nearly 50 million downloads. It was the most downloaded and listened to podcast in the history of the Joe Rogan Experience. And then it was sliced and diced and analyzed and went on all these different platforms. And then it was censored off of YouTube. And there was just an incredible reverberation. It got translated into Spanish, Korean, all these different languages. So, you know, I have to tell you, Joe Rogan has a big audience than all of mainstream media combined.
That is just amazing. And then because of you, he started having other folks on, didn't he?
Well, it started originally with several months ago. He had Brett Weinstein on, who's a evolutionary biologist, a podcaster. Brett's a very intelligent man. He had Brett on with Pierre Corey. And Pierre, they spent time on the biology of the virus and then ivermectin, but they didn't get the broad view of really the comprehensive data that we now have with COVID-19. So I laid it out as a clinical scientist, as a doctor who's seen examining COVID patients. Joe Rogan had COVID-19, so he had basically the McCullough protocol. He had what he received as the product of the efforts that myself and other team members put in the publication of these protocols. So did quarterback Aaron Rodgers. They received the same program. Right. Aaron gave credit to that in several podcasts. And so Joe was, his interest was piqued because, he had mentioned that he received monoclonal antibodies, ivermectin, prednisone, and then he got a backlash from CNN correspondent Sanjay Gupta. So he actually invited Sanjay Gupta to the studio and really schooled him about evidence for ivermectin. Sanjay Gupta and our head of the National Allergy Immunology Branch and the FDA and CDC had all said that there's no evidence for ivermectin. In fact, we had over 60 supportive studies, over 30 randomized trials. The AMA, basically a political action group, had launched a campaign early in September to abolish the use of ivermectin. Now, why would the AMA have an interest in abolishing the use of ivermectin? So Joe Rogan was primed. He got the clinical lecture from me. And then a few weeks later, he had Robert Malone, who's not a clinician, but he's a preclinical scientist, who was involved in the development of the lipid nanoparticles and the messenger RNA. And Malone went through all the preclinical data and the rationale of what these vaccines really do and why they've turned out to be such a menace on the population.
Well, it sounds like the one thing Joe Rogan hasn't heard yet, and I don't know what the impediment would be, is, myself talking about why all this is happening. I mean, he hasn't had discussions about the origins of the entire plan for COVID-19, beginning in 2010 with Bill Gates and Fauci and Klaus Schwab and the UN big player, and World Health Organization, and also the Chinese CDC working with him at the same time, and just doesn't have all that data, and the realization that the reason why the AMA has to work along with suppressing all the early treatments is they're part of that global group. And if they don't, as you know so well, if they don't suppress early treatments, then they can't have the emergency use authorization. They can't give billions of dollars to the drug companies on an emergency basis, the government. They can't rush it through the FDA without testing, without the emergency use authorization. So, because in that bill it says if you've already got a safe and effective treatment, one that's been approved in general by the FDA, you can't do this EUA, this emergency use authorization. And of course, they not only have hydroxychloroquine now, they've got ivermectin. Do you find that the people you're seeing and talking to, they just don't know those simple facts?
You know, I think they have some general awareness of it, but they just didn't realize how profound it was and how many people really suffered and died needlessly. I mean, it's absolutely terrible what's happened. I think, you know, beyond a regulatory situation, you know, the main reason to suppress hydroxychloroquine in year one and then suppress ivermectin in year two, and then actually make it really hard to find monoclonal antibodies ever since they were released, the whole goal of that is to make the population believe there's no other option than to take a vaccine. So I think, you know, I think year three is going to be the year of Pfizer. Pfizer has a pill now that's a combination of a novel chimase-like 3 inhibitor and a protease inhibitor, ritonavir. It looks safe. It looks effective. Had over 80% reductions in hospitalizations and deaths. And it's going to be the most interesting thing that when this drug comes out, what's going to be the reason why people can't be treated early with this drug in featured combinations? So year three, I predict, will be the year of the Pfizer drug and how it's potentially suppressed or delayed or made difficult to obtain.
Well, my own take is that Pfizer works very closely with Bill Gates. He's an investor. Pfizer is part of CEPI, which is the Bill Gates organization. So I don't think anything happens that they don't want to happen. First, I wonder, have you had a good look at the studies that were done for the drug, keeping in mind that they're done by Pfizer?
I have, and I can tell you it's similar to the vaccine studies. They're large. There are thousands of people in each group. But interestingly, they found very few people required hospitalization and death. So they didn't recruit a high-risk group, just like the vaccine trials didn't recruit a high-risk group. So we're left with very few endpoints. And it's unlike the studies we've seen with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, where we did actually see high-risk patients studied. So it's possible that when we get it to the real world, the Pfizer drug doesn't have such a big impact.
Well, you know, I mean, as you know, I've been looking inside drug companies for 30 years now. And you can't even believe what they write down they've done in the study. You know, I mean, when I first looked at Prozac, I was amazed to find that they just went ahead and changed the protocol for Prozac by giving the patients addictive benzos to calm them down from the Prozac. They did it without asking the FDA. And then when the FDA got to approve the drug, they had to use those trials or the drug would have failed. And they weren't going to let the drug fail. The FDA was not going to let the big deal Prozac fail. So they approved a drug that had illegal benzos being given to calm down the patients. So ever since then, I've kind of known that even what you see and read is not necessarily even represents what was done in the study. So, but it's interesting to watch, folks. I'm predicting that this is either going to be a complete failure that makes a ton of money. I don't believe they'll find a way not to not to stop the vaccines, unless they've sold as many as they think they can get away with. Maybe they just will decide they can't do the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh boosters. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch, Peter, and thank God you're watching.
Well, I predict delay, because this product was Ridgeback Pharmaceuticals had it. It was there the entire time. I mean, why are we waiting 2 years for this? They could have done the clinical trials in March and April of last year and got the drug on the market. So it's obviously they slow walked the clinical trials. Now we've got the clinical trial results. This is an easy to manufacture product. You know, they could have had this manufactured bottled up and distributed out already. So I predict delay as a strategy again. Starve the population of early treatment in order to still railroad the vaccines. Now, along the lines of Pfizer, the other news update I have is that lead attorney Aaron Seary, who sued Pfizer and the FDA for Pfizer to release its dossier on its vaccine program, its 30 microgram messenger RNA COVID-19 vaccine, the FDA's lawyer asked the federal judge initially to delay the release of the Pfizer dossier, full 400,000 pages of it, and for 55 years. There is a lead review committee. There's a public health official committee that needs to review the documents, and I know because I am the lead captain of that committee, and I can tell you at my age, I can't live 55 years to review the dossier. Fortunately, Siri prevailed in negotiating, and now the data is going to be released over the next 8 to 9 months or so. And, you know, the types of things we want to know is why are people dying? People get the vaccine. Pfizer's got a lot of detail on these deaths. Even the documents that are leaked from Pfizer, Pfizer knew about thousands of deaths early on. And so we're going to have to see what was it? Was it a heart attack? Was it a thromboembolic death? Was it related to lot numbers, certain predisposing factors? We're going to be paying a lot of attention to deaths because so many people died just a few hours or just a few days after taking a Pfizer vaccine.
Yeah, I think you've said, and I've found like about half of them die in a day and 80% in 2 days. Is that about right after the vaccine?
It's 50% in 48 hours, 80% within a week. But in my clinical practice,
okay, thank you.
Yeah, in my clinical practice, Dr. Bragan, I've seen deaths even out to 90 days. And some of these patients, they have these non-fatal events like basically arterial and venous thrombosis, case I had where she literally had blood clots throughout her body. She needed systemic anticoagulation. She developed paralysis, needed a walker. She slowly improved on anticoagulants. I saw her back for one or two visits. And then about 90 days, I got called by the Dallas County coroner that she's found home dead. And so she was perfectly fine before the vaccine. So I did report that as a vaccine-induced death.
Tell me a little more, tell us a little more about this interesting position you have heading this committee. Tell us more about that. That's very encouraging.
You know, our view on this, since Pfizer is the lead vaccine and more people have taken Pfizer than any other vaccine, that our view on this is that America needs transparency. Do you know month by month, we've had no review on safety and efficacy of the vaccines, none. Our FDA and CDC are leading the program. America deserved a once-a-month report. We need to know how many people are vaccinated, what were the safety events, how many deaths, which vaccine is working the best, and efforts to mitigate risk. We've had none of that. Right. So we've got a lot of data to review in order to piece together the puzzle of why the vaccines are so dangerous and why so many people have lost their lives. You know, we have kind of three data points on the estimated deaths. We have the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS. We're currently at 21,000 deaths. The CDC is telling us about half of those are domestic. So let's put it at 10,000 Americans that have died. We know from a CMS whistleblower lawsuit last summer that attorney Tom Rentz, working with a CMS contractor, based on in CMS data, they know who took the vaccine and when they died within a reasonable window of time. And using an extrapolation, they estimated last summer it was 45,000 Americans had lost their life with the vaccine. And now we have a paper from Columbia, Pantazatos and Seligman, using U.S. Census data as well as the Vaccine Administration data. Now, it's an ecological analysis, but they think the upper bound of the number of lives lost could be as high as 178,000 Americans may have lost their life with the COVID-19 vaccine. That's through December. That's catastrophic. I mean, that's worse than a war. That's worse than COVID-19 itself. And then this last week, we've actually seen the breaking news that the insurance industry, the actuaries, are seeing an actuarial increase in mortality in this what's called prime years of life group, the group that actually should be easily insured with little risk of death. A 40% rise is a cataclysmic rise. The actuaries have this down. You know, even a 4% rise would have been huge, but 40% rise is off the Richter scale. So everyone wants to know, why are so many Americans dying in the prime of life? The analyses from the actuaries have told us it's not COVID-19, the respiratory illness. So what else could people of that age have had as a new exposure in their life? For many of them, it was a COVID-19 vaccine.
This is such important material. As you know, I've had a lot of experience with interpreting reports to the FDA, in particular for legal cases. And I've also studied the reports to the CDC. And folks, if you have 10 reports, say to the FDA or the CDC, it could represent 100 actual events easily. In fact, one or two reports could represent 100 events. So when I heard that we were up to 10,000 reports to the CDC, it was clear to me that it could easily be 100,000 and much more. And this is from scientific data. It's not the best we could have, but scientific data on what are the reporting rates. And physicians who are doing most of the reporting rates, the healthcare people doing most of the reporting rates to the CDC, they don't want to get involved with the death of their own patients. Many of them don't know about the deaths of these patients 90 days out. Many of them, the patients have been vaccinated in, parking lots and drug stores, and there's no follow-up at all. So the reporting and the doctors are scared to death to even admit to the patients that there are any adverse effects from the vaccine. They've been terrified, which would be interesting to talk some more about with you today, just terrified. And so they're not going to be reporting much. So 10,000 reports on US alone could indicate 200,000, just some very large number. And does that make sense to you, McCullough, what I'm saying?
Yeah, Dr. Bregan, I wanted to give the exact citation for the Pantazatos.
Thank you.
And Seligman paper from Columbia, because I know in your book how precise you are with the citations. I try to be precise in my interviews. So, no, really, they have estimated from this ecological analysis that 146 to 187,000 Americans died after the vaccines between February and August of 2021. So you're right on the mark when you did that 10-to-1 relationship. It's very obviously, this is going to be a very big number. Everything is pointing to the fact that the vaccine is leading to large amounts of excess mortality. And it's just going to be an issue of how precise will the realization be and when does the realization come in, where, you know, globally it's said that the vaccines have to stop.
Yeah, and it's really somewhere between 10 to 1, which is the most conservative estimate, to 100 to 1 on any given study of the reporting to the FDA or the CDC. It's really, nobody wants to report these things, especially the medical docs.
Well, Pantazatos had that basically multiplier at 20. So you're in the ball game at 20. Yeah. So if the VAERS system, is at 10,000 domestic deaths right now, they're going to say, that's actually who reported. In VAERS, we know from a paper by Meissner and colleagues from pediatrics years ago, before COVID, 86% of the VAERS entries are made by a doctor, nurse, a paramedic, a coroner, a healthcare personnel who thinks the vaccine actually caused the death. So it's not reported by the patient. Obviously, deceased, but even the family members can't find the vaccine cards and navigate the VAERS entry. So,
yeah.
It's believed a lot of these deaths just never get recorded never. Whatsoever. And so, so we know the ones that are there, that the CDC has verified. That's what we get in the open data. We get in the verified deaths. We know those are solid. Those for sure happen. 10,000 deaths is way over the line. It should have been 50 deaths, and we shut down the program. We would have should have shut down the program in January with a proper data safety monitoring board.
Yes, as you and I both know, I mean, when we used to get 10 deaths from a vaccine, there would be a huge outcry, and people would start investigating, and by the time it reached 50, it would be off the market. 50, not 10,000 reports, 50 reports. And also, the average reporting is so important, these death issues, because people just don't go into the detail we're going into right now on deaths. We're looking at just huge, huge numbers. And the docs are scared to death. I had two episodes in my own life with family members where, I think we need to, let's take a break now. We'll pick up on why are the doctors so scared. It's break time. Well, we are back again with the amazing Peter McCullough, MD, MPH. Folks, you're hearing stuff today. You're just not going to hear other places because the interviewers can't engage the way Peter McCullough and Peter Regan are able to engage. I'd like to pick up with Dr. McCullough again on the issue of how frightened doctors are. I remember, do we have Dr. McCullough not on yet?
Yeah, I'm on. Can you see me?
All right, you're there. By the way, I have a bit of an echo in my ear to the producer. I hope it doesn't bother me at all. I just don't want it to be bothering anybody else. So, Dr. McCullough, at the close, we were saying that I was saying that I'm just seeing such fear in the faces of the doctors. I had two encounters with very nice, kind practitioners who were helping a family member of mine that I had accompanied, not Gingy, to their offices. And I asked one, are you getting a lot of COVID-19 patients? And this practitioner said, yes, if people don't get vaccinated, and I think this person knew we weren't vaccinated, we're going to have 10,000 deaths a day starting in a few weeks. I said, no. I said, that is not true at all. I have a book. This person just cut me off, turned from this thoughtful, caring to this person with fear and anger and in their face and said, that was it. And then I also had a similar experience with another very kind doc where I just happened to mention to him, by the way, I've just written a book on it, a deep dive into COVID-19 about early treatment. And this really nice man looks at me suddenly and says, that's not true. There are no controlled clinical trials. And no. He didn't say, I'd like to see the book. So let's talk about that, because, I mean, out there in the world, folks must be getting the same thing. If I'm getting it as a doctor accompanying a family member, what in the world are ordinary folks getting when they raise a question of any kind, like could this adverse effect be from the vaccine, or, is COVID-19, treatable and things like that? What's your experience, sir? I know you were worried about this before I was. You were telling me way back something's the matter with our doctors before I kind of knew it.
The doctors have been injected with fear, and the fear has led to all kinds of irrational behaviors. they clearly don't want to see any data on vaccine safety and efficacy. You bring it up and they are dismissive. I had a podcast today with a young podcaster, a young, handsome young man. Both his parents are physicians. And, you know, he had COVID. And so he was going to go home and see him at Christmas. And they said, you have to be vaccinated before you come home and see us. And he said, you know, I don't want to take the vaccine. I've already had some medical problems. A young guy takes care of himself really well. And his parents shamed him into getting the vaccine. And then it turns out by the time he got home for Christmas, his parents, who were, you know, fully vaccinated, developed COVID themselves. And I said, you know, it was clear that despite how nice and well-intentioned his parents are, they were actually attempting to use him as a human shield. That, in fact, they viewed their son as a potential vector of the virus, which we know with the legacy variants couldn't happen, that once you had COVID, that you were immune. Now with the Omicron variant, it's clearly broken through. And even those with natural immunity and with vaccine immunity get the Omicron variant. It's very mild, transient, and it gives lasting immunity, both to Omicron and to back immunity to Delta. But well, what type of distorted thinking gets into the minds of parents who are both physicians and they have a child, and the child's already had COVID? They must know that the child's at negligible risk to come home for Christmas, but yet they wanted to force the vaccine and all the risks of the vaccine onto this child. The FDA has warnings that say that vaccines in his age group cause myocarditis, heart damage. And the CDC VAERS system has loads of cases, over 20,000 cases of myocarditis. What would get into these parents' minds to put him at risk for heart injury just so he can come home for Christmas?
It's very, very, very sad. One of the issues that also occurs, I want to try to look with you today the toughest issues that our audience may be looking at, because you are the best source of information in the whole world. We're giving vaccines to children. Everything I've seen and talked about with my colleagues indicates that the vaccine is much, much, much more dangerous for a five-year-old than COVID, whose danger of death approaches zero in a 5 or 10 or 15-year-old, and it's pretty very low even in an 18-year-old. Could you talk a little bit about this pushing vaccines onto the youngsters? And let me say in advance, folks, the reason that this is being done, I believe, is part of cowing us, controlling us, intimidating doctors, getting us deeper into authoritarianism and totalitarianism and to what's called the Great Reset, getting us more and more under the influence of the global predators. And believe me, if you read COVID-19 and the global predators, you'll understand how much the UN and its ties to China and the World Health Organization are pushing totalitarianism. Nowhere in any of their discussions of how to handle a pandemic, nowhere in all the books and articles, hundreds of speeches and videos by all these guys, our top billionaires, our top companies, who, everybody else, is there a reference to something like the individual right to control what's put in his body? You know, to the very thing that the progressive community is so emphasized, you know, that, you know, my body, my feet is my body. And now they're taking a position now you don't have any control over your body because it's the public good. And it's just devastating our democracy. So I know the reason why they want to do it. Klaus Schwab said, we will vaccinate everybody a couple of years before all this started, because that's how they're going to get everybody to accept everything. And now we're learning they are discussing in the poorer countries. I don't know if you've heard this, Peter. In the poorest countries, they're talking about giving the people tracking devices into their bodies, little tracking devices along with the vaccine so they can keep track of them. And there's actually a manufacturer involved. I don't know if you've heard about this yet. But talk about the children's issues.
Well, we know that a child, in terms of
you okay, Peter? You everybody's going to want to know. You're not getting sick, are you?
No, I have
Dr. McCullough.
I have just a cold, not COVID. I just have an upper respiratory tract.
Okay.
So we know with children that the chances of dying of COVID are way, way, way less than 1%. We know the chances of being hospitalized with COVID are way, way, way less than 1%. In fact, they can be expressed in less than 1 per million. 1 per million. So we have data now from Scharf and colleagues from Kaiser Permanente Northwest, putting the rate of myocarditis or heart injury, and the peak age is 18 to 24, that number is between 400 and 500 cases per million. So it's many hundredfold greater to be damaged with the vaccines and get myocarditis than it is to take your chances with COVID-19, the respiratory illness. I've seen countless young people and children get COVID-19, and it's like a mild cold. It's similar to what I have now. It's just a cold that we will get through with some conservative home measures. So what's going on here is that people are being forced against their will to take injections in their body that are going to do harm.
We've never seen anything like this in medicine. I remember one of our first conversations, I think it was in March 2020. I don't know if that's possible. We were saying things that I hadn't thought about, like never in the history of medicine have doctors been told they had to act so much against their conscience that they couldn't even use a proven safe treatment in the ways they saw fit, using their good judgment, especially when there were thousands of doctors using this judgment. This is nothing like we've ever seen before. It's the use of medicine to crush, I think, the Western democracies.
It's clear that the doctors have been co-opted, that it was clear to get the doctors into some type of capture. The term that's being used now is regulatory capture. With all the federal funds that have gone to medical groups and university medical centers and other healthcare institutions, there's a lot of FAQs that go out with those funds. And the FAQs say that the institutions will follow NIH guidelines. And the NIH guidelines specifically say, don't use drugs to treat COVID-19. So they're basically a set of negative guidance. The FAQs clearly say that these institutions and these doctors will support the vaccine program without question. So regulatory capture plays a giant role here. Most physicians believe their career is on the line if they observe something with the vaccines that goes against their conscience. So what each doctor is having to wrestle with is, do they let this go on? And, you know, this kind of sick feeling of doing something wrong, being complicit, or do they speak out?
And folks, it may seem impossible to understand how NIH could be working so closely with Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and the UN and the World Health Organizations and ultimately with the Communist Chinese. But I'll give you one real example that we have in the book, and now I can add something to it. The organization CEPI, which is the Bill Gates organization that works with the World Health Organization to divide up the world. They have got it all documented, their communication. Gates and CEPI are going to run all the pharmaceutical stuff, and the World Health Organization was going to tell everybody in the medical profession what to do with the next pandemic. Well, one of the chief advisors to CEPI was Rick Bright. And Rick Bright was the head of BARDA under Trump till he removed him much too late. The head under Trump who was controlling all the flow of money to go to Moderna and to Pfizer, the pet projects of CEPI and Bill Gates. And he even, now he's left and gone to the big foundation. Oh gosh, I'm blocking on its name.
Rockefeller,
thank you. He's gone to Rockefeller, and in his little bio, he brags about how he was a chief advisor to CEPI, to these billionaires and these big drug companies going back to at least 2015. That's the kind of date. So then I looked some more, and since the book came out, I found out that when CEPI was formed, they by the midsummer of 2017, they got their permanent director in, and he is he's called CEO for life. I don't know, Dr. McCullough, about you. I've never heard of anybody appointed CEO for life. And who was he? He was the acting director of BARDA for 5 years. So that's how close these billionaires reach into the heart of the government. And the acting and the directors of BARDA are also, I forget whether it's associate or assistant, directors of Health and Human Services. So they're just right in the thick of things. And Fauci, of course, was very involved from early on as well. They know each other, they're buddies, they're co-criminals, co-conspirators. So these are some of the details we've been picking up lately. Peter, what are you thinking as another subject? Let's get the really tough things out to people.
Thank you, Dr. Bregan. One of the great issues facing America right now are the vaccine mandates. The Biden CMS mandates originally came out via press release. There was a backlash, and the Sixth Circuit Court, federal court, but Judge Doughty, who relied on my testimony and the testimony of Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford. Both Jay and myself are frequent contributors to Fox News, but we also, you know, provide commentary through you know, big space in America. He cited both of our reports in Judge Doughty's decision, his over 30-page decision, to stay the Biden mandates. Biden then appealed to the Supreme Court. Now the Supreme Court is, you know, had their opening statements. And America was stunned when the Supreme Court justices, in trying to establish a fact pattern, grossly exaggerated the facts, including Sotomayor, Kagan, and others. I mean, grossly. Sotomayor said there's hundreds of thousands of children in the hospital, many on ventilators, and that's so far from the truth. The hospitals are very inactive right now. There is some panic hospitalization that occurs, but it's very mild. I'm managing dozens and dozens of patients, nobody near hospitalization, including those in the upper 80s and 90s now. Omicron is so mild. And to see these gross exaggerations that even other government officials have to walk back, and to have that in the record of the Supreme Court as they deliberate on the mandates is really a testament in history of how grossly distorted things have become in the minds of those in the highest positions in the land. And then Luc Montier, who from France, who won the Nobel Prize, and Jed Rubenfire in the Wall Street Journal have an op-ed that basically states now with Omicron, the virus has mutated to the point where it's obsolete. It's basically the vaccines are obsolete. The whole issue is obsolete. We have data from Hansen. We have data from from Hansen in the Denmark, and we have data from the UK Health Security Report, both showing with Omicron that the vaccines have zero efficacy against Omicron, zero. And so the bottom line is the vaccines are now obsolete. The Supreme Court is trying to decide on mandates that would invoke the use of a useless vaccine on the population with all the dangers and caveats that we've already gone over.
This is very, very important stuff. We have a little less than 5 minutes left. This is an extremely informative program in every possible way. I want to tell folks about the book in terms of what's happening now. We are up and running again and have been for a few weeks now on our own independent website that we have set up for the book called wearethepray.com. We are the prey. .com, and you can get it at a reduced rate on wearethepray.com. And anywhere in the world, including America, you can also get it on internet, like Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or Books A Million, or whatever else that is on the internet. And Dr. McCullough is one of three people who wrote really lovely introductions to the book, along with Zev Zelenko, another hero, and Leva Lead MD, three docs doing great work. Peter, are you getting good feedback on the book?
Yeah, I certainly am. There's no doubt about it. We've had major book signings in cities across the country. I've been going out giving public seminars, and myself and in teams, mainly supported by the Association of American Physician and Surgeons and other great grassroots organizations. We're getting 500 to 5,000 people attending. We typically have a session for lawmakers, a session for doctors, and then an open public session where we go over the data, much like we did today. And I tell you, these sessions are packed. People are taking half a day off of work because they know they've been stonewalled on the data on COVID-19. They want to learn a lot more. And many of them have your book in their hands. They are reading every page because America wants to know what is going on. They know things are going wrong. It's affecting their lives dramatically. They've seen loved ones that have been lost due to the respiratory illness, and now those have been lost due to the vaccine.
I think a good closing observation, folks, is how great work Peter McCullough is doing. Great work that hundreds of people are doing, many of them responding to Dr. Peter McCullough's work. I'm more optimistic now than I've been in recent months, so maybe even since it all began. So I want to just tell folks things are getting better. Things are getting better out there. It's getting more interesting in terms of the response to the people like myself and especially to Dr. McCullough. Is that your impression?
It's true. President Biden, right before Christmas, had a message to American seniors and told them that they're in for a long, dark, deadly winter of hospitalization and death with COVID-19. And I can't think of a more dark, depressing, terrible message for the leader of the free world to give its senior citizens. They've endured 2 years of this. And so I came out on America Out Loud and had a strong statement of joy, of hope, that we will find our way through this pandemic. We know how to treat this disease. We know how to provide compassionate care and get people through the pandemic. And literally my face was side by side with Biden, and the Biden administration has no response. They have nowhere to go. Such a dark, terrible statement for the country.
Now what we need to do, folks, is to grab on to this and join the Liberty Movement. Find people who are standing up for America, for patriotism, for freedom. And if you also believe in it for God, you don't have to. But it's telling that almost none of the global predators believe in either God, America, or patriotism. But join the freedom movement. And really, God bless all of you. And Peter McCullough, Dr. McCullough, thank you for being here with us. Thank you so much.